Blog Talk Radio.
It is time once again for America's Most Haunted Radio. I'm Eric Olson, and I am very excited to be here with Zach Carlson, who is one of the producers of the brand new documentary film on Halloween Home Haunters, The American Scream. I love that name. Obviously, a take on the American dream and tying into, you know, people scream at Halloween and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Welcome, Zach.
Hello, how are you?
How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm excited.
I was just watching the film on the promo on Vimeo. And it cut off halfway through. It was literally halfway through. I mean, like, to the second. It was halfway through. So I'll tell you what, I am enthralled with that first half. Why don't you give people a little bit of – actually, I'll read a little bit of the description here. Once I get going with the reading, then I go, God, it sounds like I'm reading. But let's let people know a little bit. Halloween is what you make it. Every October, sleepy Fairhaven, Massachusetts – erupts with ambitiously creative spookery. Endless styrofoam tombstones, backyard beasts appear courtesy of a few supremely dedicated local home haunters who have devoted their lives to the art of handmade monster making and haunted decorating. The American Scream film documentary follows three of these families to uncover the triumphs and tragedies that come with carrying on the true Halloween DIY spirit. So that's what it's about. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your involvement and how the film came about and what's going on with it?
Well, Chiller Network, who are premiering the film on TV on the 28th, they had approached Michael and Lindsay after seeing Best Worst Movie, their former documentary, and they had liked that so much that they wanted to work with Michael and Lindsay on a new project. And I'd gotten to know the two of them through Best Worst Movie, which I was in as an interviewee but not working on as a producer. And Michael said, hey, what do you think of this idea about this, you know, documentary about Halloween stuff that Chiller had approached them with? And I am a huge Halloween fan and a big horror nerd, and I said that I thought it sounded great. And he said, well, we got to figure out how to make this thing, you know, that there's not much time to kind of figure out who they would be profiling and documenting and, you know, where we'd go or anything. And so I just jumped into it and started kind of researching all of the different people who do this, you know, home haunting stuff in a huge way. So I ended up being that it was, you know, Lindsay working from their house in California, and then me, Michael, and the director of photography, Katie, kind of zipping around the Northeast. We only had 6 weeks to figure out who we were going to shoot and then to make a feature-length documentary before Halloween hit.
Good Lord, that seems impossible. So when were you actually shooting it?
I mean, we didn't start making it until mid-September, you know, and we really didn't even know which state we were going to be in and who we were going to be following at all. And we were able to kind of figure out a specific area between – or not so specific area, between the northeast tip of the country and all the way down through D.C. And we were so fortunate to find Fairhaven, Massachusetts, which is where the entire movie ended up being shot. We were originally thinking we'd have to be shooting people in different cities, and it just wouldn't have had the same warmth and wouldn't have allowed the same familiarity for the viewer, you know, of really getting to know these people and their community. And that's kind of one of the best things about the movie, as it turns out, is that this small town has so much Halloween spirit in it.
Yeah, I mean, the three main players, the three families, they're right within the same neighborhood, right?
Yeah, I mean, Victor, well, for the listeners, there's kind of three personalities and three main households. You know, Victor is a perfectionist. He's an IT guy, you know, and a very precise sort of person. And then two blocks away from his house was Manny, who's kind of more of like a blue-collar, you know, like making everything work kind of guy. You know, he'll turn anything he finds into part of his Halloween decoration. And then it was only about a 1 minute drive from those two over to the Broders, who are kind of just like the more, you know, hitting their thumb with the hammer, but still getting their Halloween stuff done. And
the father and son.
Right. And they're kind of like, you know, people have said in reviews that they're sort of the comic relief, but they definitely have their own very real personalities and full story as well.
Well, they're literally the comic relief. They are also clowns.
Yeah, that's true. They are. And what's funny is we went out there to visit Victor, who'd applied, you know, we had done an outreach trying to find different haunters, and Victor had written to us. And then he introduced us to Manny when we were down the street, and it wasn't until we had already decided we were going to shoot in Fairhaven and chronicle those two that Manny mentioned, like, oh, you should see these guys down the street. It's these two, you know, it's these two fellas. They do this crazy haunt over there. And we went over to the house, and it was still even later that we found out they were clowns, so this stuff just kind of blossomed, and we were so fortunate.
It is inconceivable to me. I mean, just what little I know of film production and television production. I guess I have a more of a direct personal relationship to TV, although I did work briefly on a softcore Japanese porn movie being filmed in Malibu, California in about 1980-something. I was a driver. I was at the top of my game. Anyway, from what little I know, you know, directly, it just seems inconceivable to me that what we are seeing, what I am seeing in looking at, you know, a finished half anyway of the finished product was just shot like a month ago. I mean, it's inconceivable. Is it the digital aspect that has enabled you to speed that up?
This was a year ago. This is all
2011. Oh, it's a year ago.
Right. But we were under that, you know, we were
Thank
under the
goodness.
Constraint of Halloween.
I was going to lose my mind.
Yeah, it was just, you know, our deadline was just set by the fact that the holiday was coming in 6 weeks from when we started, you know.
Okay, got it.
So, and so it was just as tight a deadline as if we had started then. You know, we just now have had the benefit of a year to edit it. You know,
yeah, I was going
to
say, just editing right. alone, I know, takes just hours and hours and hours. Especially, I would think, in a documentary where you're not exactly sure what you're looking for, right? You're just kind of shooting a lot of different things and then kind of deciding as you go how you're going to piece it together, right?
Yeah, I mean, there were 270 hours of footage between the three Haunters households. And so the real heroic, you know, acts and the real praise needs to go to editor Andrew Matthews, who really sifted through all that stuff. And then, of course, Katie Graham and the director Michael and this guy Kyle Bronson all had to pitch in and really dig through that stuff to make it a 90-minute film, which is a hell of a lot of work.
It really is. Hey, have we told people? I guess it's debuted right at down in Austin, was it?
Right. It had its first screenings at Fantastic Fest, which is primarily, you know, horror films, sci-fi films, and very non-real world content. But a documentary like this sort of lends itself to that. And it played down there, and it was voted best documentary at the festival, which was a really nice feeling. And you know, a great surprise because there's a lot of other good stuff that played. And then it's since then, unexpectedly, got a lot of theaters approaching us to run it. And so we did a limited number of screenings for it. And then it's going to play on TV this Sunday on Chiller.
Cool. Now, is Chiller the thing? I have to admit, I've avoided Chiller because we don't get it in HD. Is there an HD Chiller?
I don't know if there is.
I mean, where I am, I'm in Northeast Ohio, and our cable system, it's Time Warner, does not have it in HD. I'm just wondering if it exists elsewhere, and we just don't have it, or because, I mean, it would seem to me to watch something like this film, I mean, don't you want to see it in that kind of high definition?
I mean, you know, you're looking at the real world, and so to me, I think that it's, you know, the stories of these people come across regardless of the technical format, and I'm not just saying that, you know, as a way to convince you to promote the TV screening.
As a producer of the film?
No, I'm really not. I mean, I personally don't have a Blu-ray player. I'm very content just to watch things in standard definition. So that's my personal bias. But I think if a story is good, you know, It's the story that counts. I think it's a new network anyway, and maybe they haven't, you know, had the opportunity to also create an HD channel. I think a lot of times that needs to happen gradually. But I'm so caveman-like and so far removed from, you know, HD awareness that I'm probably the last person that could answer that with any sort of authority.
Well, we will look into it. And I agree with you. I mean, if there's any format that probably does not require the scintillating detail of high def, it probably is this really what's very quite gentle. It's a very gentle documentary, and ultimately you're really talking about the relationships within these families, and it's very interesting to see the varying levels of commitment. I really enjoy the dynamic between the husbands, the wives, the kids, and their varying levels of commitment and enjoyment. And then, of course, you have the father and son, and that's yet another dynamic. You have the bachelors, you know, off doing their own thing and going off and being clowns together and working on their haunt with at least for the first half of the film with just one female friend who's involved and therefore the encouragement of it. Of course, we don't want to give away the ending, and I don't even know what the ending is, but it appears that some of our participants are perhaps more ambitious than others and heading in the direction of perhaps a professional haunt. Is that a reasonable assumption? Does that end up entering into the picture?
Well, Victor is our kind of primary focus in the doc. And he has realized, I mean, and it's not arrogance on his part, but he's really realized that he's got this incredible, like almost superhuman ability to create, you know, a haunt and to create like Halloween imagery that's super innovative and new. And so he just, I think, doesn't feel like a financial ambition as much as like a duty to create Halloween magic for as many people as possible. So he does start getting more and more driven to create a professional haunt where people can come from all over and enjoy it, and it's more than just his neighborhood. But it's a very pure ambition on his part, and I don't want to give away what happens, but
right.
it's just like seeing somebody, you know, almost like, you know, Old Testament drive, like, I must build this ark, I must make this haunt, you know, it's just like, it's like in him to do this thing. Yeah, and so he really does. And yeah, actually, the Field of Dreams analogy totally works. It's just like, this is what he was born to do, and he really feels it, and I think the viewer really feels it. And as you were saying before, like, you know, that's kind of the story of the movie. It isn't about haunted houses or, you know, the movie's shot beautifully on, you know, fancy filmmaking equipment, but the story is what everybody responds to, and whether they came in expecting to get scared or to see the technical workings of a haunted house, what they really come out of is just like these people's stories kind of punch them in the face and really get the reaction.
Right. Certainly we are seeing kind of as the film is unfolding, we're certainly seeing the processes as each of the families are working on their haunted houses. So you're seeing that kind of step by step, but it, you're right. It's almost incidental. That's kind of the action through which the family stories kind of unfold, and you get to know the relationships. What's Victor's wife's name? She seems to be the long suffering type. You know, she's not really all that interested in it, but she wants to be supportive. And you see her when she's talking, it's like she's talking to herself. On the one hand, she's, well, yeah, that is a pretty big chunk of change, that $200 for the used coffin. And I love that, the line about, yes, that was a previously occupied coffin.
Yeah.
That they're bringing into their house. What a crack up. Yeah, but that's a pretty big chunk of change. On the other hand, He's not into sports, so he's not buying tickets to the football games, and he's not into camping or this or that. You know, so you're kind of running through her thought process with her. I love that. She reminds me of some women I know.
She's a Victor's wife's named Tina, and she's a really great focus in the movie because she has the role of being the logical head of the family, you know, like in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, Victor's an incredible father, and he's so devoted to his family, but he's also devoted to this vision, and so Tina is there to rein him in. But the irony with her is that she says, well, this is his thing, and I have to be supportive of it, but when you see her participating in the preparations for the haunt, she is also so devoted, probably more so than she realizes, than she'd admit, and she ends up getting, as Halloween gets closer, she just becomes almost equally focused and devoted to the thing, and she's making sure that, you know, his vision becomes possible, and she realizes that it's a really great thing for their family, you know, because their two daughters, Catherine and Gwen, also get drawn into it, and it really unifies them in a lot of ways. I mean, it's a pretty harrowing experience for them every year, but ultimately it's this thing that they do, that they devote themselves to together, that is something stronger than a lot of families have.
Well, sure. It's certainly a communal project. At the beginning of the film, the daughter Gwen is less interested, less sold. It seems like maybe this is the year where she kind of throws herself into it. Is that what
Catherine,
we're saying?
Catherine's the older of the two daughters, and she is, I mean, you know, she is hungry for Halloween adventure, like, all the time. I mean, she's all year round into it like her dad, and she
just like
destroys dolls and paints them in blood. And
I love that.
She's the real deal. And then her younger sister is just more of a typical kid who likes Christmas more because there's presents, and, you know, Halloween is...
And it's nice!
Yeah. She likes the niceness of Christmas, but, you know, just like her mom, she says that she maintains a distance, an arm's length from Halloween, but you see her start to get pulled into it, and I think it's sort of an inescapable aspect of being a member of the Barateau family, that Halloween, whether or not you extol its virtues, you know, Halloween is in your blood.
So what I was thinking, and again, I guess I have to keep reiterating that I did only see the first half, which is probably not bad, or I'd be giving away too much anyway because I'm a notorious blabbermouth. But what I was thinking throughout that is, at least in the first half, what I did not see addressed is why Halloween for each of these people. You know, you're seeing the process. There's zero question about their enthusiasm, about their dedication. But none of them really address the question or the issue of, why do I do this specifically for Halloween? Because they could certainly put this level of time and interest and attention into Christmas, for example. I mean, there's certainly people who put that level of time and effort and expense into decorating for Christmas. I mean, there's so many parallels between Christmas and Halloween, at least in America, or I should say especially probably in America. The way I've come to think of it is they're mirror images. They're two sides kind of the same coin. That's a separate matter that we can talk about also. But I'm just wondering if at any point in the movie, or just if do you have an opinion, what do you think it is about Halloween specifically that drives these people?
The answer to that is a really tremendous focus towards the end of the movie, and the reason that it's held until that point is because it's kind of a big reveal about Victor himself and his personality and where that drive comes from. But because it's been revealed so many times in the press, I think that it's okay for me to talk a little bit about it here. There's specifics for each of them. The father and son clowns, they look to Halloween as a thing that gets people out who can then make donations while they're touring the yard to go towards the charities that the father and son are involved with. Right. So that's a practical reason for their dedication to it.
Less than philosophical.
Right.
Or cultural.
And then Manny just loves seeing all the kids in the neighborhood have something to do and get there and get scared, which is kind of like the more pervasive reason that people do this. You know, like this is the reason that most haunters do it. But Victor, being probably the most like dangerously overdedicated haunter in our movie, his reason runs very deep, and it's because the religion that his parents were part of when he was growing up forbade the celebration of Halloween.
Oh.
And, you know, even birthdays, and it was a very specific religion that is expanded on in the movie. But he was just completely not allowed to acknowledge Halloween at all. And he watched all the other kids get dressed up and have fun and eat candy. And he just felt that that was being completely, you know, withheld from him, that joy of youth and that fun. And so when he finally was able to follow his own path as an adult, that manifested in a complete obsession with Halloween. And because, and this is something that is true for all three of the main subjects of the movie, as he says in it, at the end of the film, Victor kind of steps back and acknowledges what is so magical to him about the holiday. And it's that, he said, Christmas, you know, Christmas is a family holiday. Thanksgiving is something you do with your family, but Halloween is the only holiday that brings an entire community together. And that's something that is so rare and special. And it could be said, you know, that that's something that's less and less a focus of, you know, for people. Community is that everybody's stuck inside on their internet and kind of playing with their phone all the time. There's just less focus on community. And Victor is really touched by the fact that Halloween is the one time a year where everybody leaves the house and does things together with friends and strangers and just experiences a holiday, you know, as a whole.
Interesting. Well, I'm very excited to see the last half of it. I can see now, you know, I mean, it seemed sort of odd to me that issue wasn't addressed, but now I understand that was on purpose. And that sounds like a very interesting and satisfying sort of emotional conclusion. And I certainly see why you guys saved it for that. Now, what did you say exactly? What was your role exactly in the film? I know you're producer, but what did that mean in regards to this film specifically?
Well, producer can mean so many things, and it's like so many
right.
different roles. It's a pretty vague title. In this case, I was one of three people that actually were the hands-on team. Michael Stevenson, the director, and Katie Graham, the director of photography, and I figured out what we were going to do, who we were going to, you know, profile for the movie, and it was a ton of work. We put out an initial call saying, hey, does anybody in the Northeast specifically, you know, do they do this type of home haunting? And we had anticipated that we would get a few dozen responses, maybe 50 or 60 at the most. And we got ultimately about 600 people that wrote to us and are like, you know, oh, choose me, right? Come visit me, take a look at this giant spider I made, you know. And so I sifted through all those, called people, looked at their YouTube videos to see, you know, what their haunts looked like. So I was kind of trying to do a lot of work for the casting of the film and spearhead that as much as I could. And then we narrowed that down to, I guess, entertainingly 13 home haunters that we went out and drove to and visited, and then narrowed that down to our final focus of Fairhaven. And then once that was done, my role as producer was just to get everything organized and, you know, with Michael and Katie and everyone else that came out to help. We only had a crew of five making a feature-length documentary in 6 weeks. We just had to get everything worked out, and everybody was all hands on deck all the time. So, and then other producers involved, you know, did things at the business level and things that I have not had experience in doing, but I was sort of like the two-fisted blue-collar producer while other people were more, you know, business-minded and, you know,
you were the nuts and bolts kind of guy.
Yeah, I think I was the guy you know, trying to make sure that there were no holes in the ship while it was floating and make sure that we knew where we were sailing to. And
we actually have a question. I'm looking. I always forget to look at the chat because I'm an idiot. But Babette would like to know, Babette Bombshell, I don't want her to be confused with any other Babettes, what experience have you had other than this in working with Chiller, and do you have any plans to work with them in the future?
Well, this is the first time that we've met them. I mean, you know, Michael and Lindsay had initially, you know, been dealing with them, and then I met people from Chiller while we were out in Fairhaven making the movie. This was also Chiller's first experience in, you know, backing a documentary project, which is the opposite from doing a, you know, post-apocalyptic zombie invasion movie, right? So they were,
right.
Everybody was kind of dipping their feet in the pool at the same time, which was a great experience because, you know, it was everyone entering sort of at the same level with the same amount of excitement, and that was really great. And having worked with them and been able to communicate with them, and they always seemed to be very present and very open to ideas, and they weren't, you know, backseat driving at all. They were very trusting of Michael and Lindsay's abilities because they'd enjoyed the previous movie. So really, it's, you know, you're dealing with a larger company who's part of an even larger company. You expect there to be a lot of, you know, frowning and meddling and all this stuff, and they've been the opposite. They've been really open, and their ideas have always been, you know, appreciated and welcome, but never domineering. And I would definitely want to work with them again. In fact, I would hope that we get to do something with them maybe every year, you know. I mean, maybe not this type of project, but definitely, you know, continue the relationship with them.
Well, that sounds good. Did they give you any parameters? I mean, were there any guidelines when you were putting this together?
The idea was initially there, so it was surprising how few constraints they put on the project. I mean, you know, they knew they wanted a documentary about people doing, you know, home haunting stuff. And so they said they thought it would be good if it was the Northeast because that is a place where it looks and feels like Halloween, and that's totally true. You know, the changing of the seasons and the traditions
right.
of the Northeast from the Salem witches on, you know, like there's a lot of pretty, you know, concrete Halloween background up there that most parts of the country just don't share. So that was a great bit of guidance from them. And then beyond that, they were just always open for discussion as if they were just collaborators on the project instead of the executive producers of it.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like it's really been a very positive experience all the way around. I'm curious, what's the budget for something like this?
Well, it's, you basically start with a very low baseline and see if, you know, see what your needs are. So I think it was pretty flexible. I mean, we definitely were well under, you know, seven figures with it. And I don't know how excited they'd be if I revealed, you know, the specific numbers. But, you know, it's a documentary is great because you don't have to deal with all the expenses of a feature, you know, and you can just do it with a bare bones crew. But
and you don't have to pay the talent.
Right. I mean, you know, and honestly, so many people are excited to help that, you know, we had friends offering to just come out and be involved in the production just for room and board, you know, which we didn't end up doing because we were all traveling around in one little car. But I mean, I'd say this movie was made probably for the cost of a nice boat. I don't know. I don't know how else to put it. A nice small
okay.
boat for two. But I mean, and I think it's good. It's good to keep a project budgeted at the size of the project. You don't want to kind of create like an aesthetic for the movie that is bigger, much less smaller than, you know, than what it needs to be effective. And I think that this is like a pretty, you know, it's a really compelling story about modest people that don't have huge egos that just want to make the world more fun and better. And so that was
no,
the way that the production
I agree.
Approached.
Absolutely. They really, that was something that really did stand out is a relative lack of ego. That, you know, it wasn't about me, I'm doing this because of me and I want all this attention. That doesn't come across that way at all. It really does seem to be something larger for all these people, and that their motivation is not just simply to draw attention to themselves.
Well, that's what's kind of so great about this, is like it's a selfless thing, because nobody has ever become famous for decorating their yard, you know, and these people,
until now.
And so these people have always done this thing strictly because they think that it's going to be good for those around them in various ways, you know, good for their families, good for their neighbors, you know, just good for memories. And that's what came up a lot in the movie. It's like all these people saying, you know, I'm creating memories for these kids, or like, and then that's just what seems to be appreciated by everyone. And it's kind of this unspoken gratitude that people have for their neighbors that are doing this.
Well, and again, in the first half, sorry to keep reiterating that, because I don't want people to think I've seen the second half, because I could be wrong, you know, with things I say based on the first. But anyway, it really does come through in all three families, kind of as different as they are, that they all see this as a bonding thing. I mean, it's explicitly said by, I believe it's Manny, when he's talking about working on it with his kids, and that it's a bonding experience, and that's part of what he really, really likes about it, and that it's something they can all throw themselves into and get to know each other better. And I thought that was really quite touching. It's really clear that that's what's going on with Victor's family. And then, of course, you have the father and son, where the friend, the woman who's the friend of Matt, the son, says, you know, very explicitly again, yeah, Matt's father is his best friend. You know, they're basically together all the time.
It's true. I mean, you know, and a lot of this is like seeing people at war, you know, where there's like everything is going on around them, and things are detonating and all these problems are arising, and they just have to like stick together. And sometimes, you know, there's panic and bickering and, you know, those types of things that happen under duress. But ultimately, like these are situations where everyone ends up being very open with each other and really getting to know each other. And we were just doing our best to stay out of the way and document it and, you know, kind of have them treat each other as they normally do in these situations. I mean, it's a really intense time. Even like 2 weeks out from Halloween, like just, you know, like the deadline is looming and like the, you know, the clock is ticking loud and like all these people are really scrambling. And I mean, it's something that other families and definitely my family never had. And even though it's, you know, everyone's breaking out in a cold sweat, I mean, I'm pretty jealous that they have this, you know, and I think it comes across in the movie that, like, it's hard as hell for them to deal with this thing every year, but they are stronger because of it.
Sure, and I'm sure they get a very strong sense of accomplishment when they're able to pull it off each time.
Yeah, and that's sort of the most bittersweet thing. A lot of movies, even documentaries now, are able to have a villain or manufacture or actually capture like real, you know, I guess, difficulties and adversity in their movie. But the thing about this movie is like it wasn't supposed to be that. There wasn't like a furious church group that was trying to shut down the Halloween in the town, you know, like it was just about these people's own struggle, you know, to do this thing on their own. And so the saddest thing about the movie isn't any sort of, you know, resistance to what they're doing, but it's more just like all of this work goes in and all of this effort, and then inevitably it's over and how it ends. That's
hard. Think of The Hangover.
Right. And it's like that Neil Armstrong thing after he walked on the moon. He's like, well, you know, what am I supposed to do now?
Now what am I going to do?
Right. So there's like a sort of a postpartum depression.
Right.
That Hunter's
right.
Getting.
That's a great analogy. I'm sure it is. I'm sure you really got to, you know, your sense of purpose is over all
yeah.
of a sudden, you know. Or you said you compared it to military, you know, that too. Look at the problems so many soldiers have after they get out of that the craziness of war. And, you know, part of it is that they don't have that unifying purpose anymore.
Right.
Hey, let's talk about, well, no, I was going to say, let's talk about you a little bit because we really haven't. But since we're talking about the film, let's remind people, the film will be shown, The American Scream. It will be shown on NBC Universal's Chiller Network, October 28th at 8 o'clock. And then it will also be screening in select theaters through November. And what's interesting is American Scream is participating in this, what do we call Tug? What is Tug? I guess it's a platform, right?
It's like a service for people who want to sort of program their own movies.
Yeah, it's neat. So you can get to Scream, the Tug facility service through their site, and their site is just what you might think, theamericanscream.com. But you can
movie, if you don't mind.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, yes, please tell me, because, you know, being wrong is not helpful at all. Yes, there it is. There it is. I was just speaking off the top of my head like a bonehead. TheAmericanScreamMovie.com. And so wherever you are, whatever town you're in, whatever city, you can actually request that the film be shown live, in the theater, in your town, via Tug. So that is kind of an interesting approach. So are there any confirmed screenings yet for November, or is that all still being worked on?
Do you mean just for regular theatrical or through Tug?
Yeah. Just
yeah,
any...
There are quite
screen.
A few. Yeah.
Okay, great. And
we
it's
were...
available through the site?
Yeah, we should have all the screening dates are being updated on the regular website.
Okay.
And then Tug stuff will be there too. But after it played at that festival in Austin,
right?
You know, several theater programmers were there for the shows and heard about it online, and we got a pretty heartening number of emails from people who just said, hey, I heard about this from my friend, or, you know, I saw this online and we really want to play it, and we've just been excited to basically say yes to everybody who's wanted it to run in their city.
I see. Now I'm actually on the site, and I'm in mm-hmm. the screening portions. And, wow, it's been showing. You're showing all through October as well.
Yeah, we started up right after the festival ended at the end of September, and it's just been great. So.
Wow, sensational. Well, coming up, let's see here. We have... Hong Kong today. Is that today?
Yes.
The 23rd, anyway. It's hard to
today.
Coordinate with Hong Kong. But, yeah, and then tomorrow and the 26th at the Philadelphia Film Festival. And director Michael Paul Stevenson will be there in person tomorrow. Also 26th, 27th, Music Box Theater in Chicago. Coming up the 28th, the Seacoast Repertory Theater in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and on and on. Alamo Draft House in Houston on the 1st. Now, you're affiliated with the Alamo Draft House, right?
Right. I am. Well, for the last 7 years, I've been one of the film programmers there, meaning I select the older movies that play there and kind of battle against the new movies like Avatar. So,
tell people a little bit, people who don't know what the Alamo Draft House is, why don't you just give them a little bit of a rundown on what that actually is. You're in Austin, right?
Yeah, it's an Austin-based business that's currently expanding to all kinds of places in the U.S., but it's in its heart, it's just a theater that appreciates old movies as much as new ones and runs everything as, you know, 35mm, 70mm, lowbrow, highbrow, and also serves food and drinks, including alcohol, which seems to get a lot of attention as well.
Yeah, that seems to make sense to me, you know?
Yeah.
What the heck? If you're going to have a movie theater, you might as well make it comfy.
And the other thing about the Alamo that gets attention is that if people talk at all during the movie or, you know, look at their cell phone or text, that we just kick them out in the street and
literally
tell them to not come back.
You kick them physically hard.
I would love to, but that barely ever happens. Although my wife did end up punching out one of the attendees at a recent show because the girl was talking so much.
Wow.
But the girl
threw the
first punch.
Pretty serious about this business.
Oh, yeah, we all are. So, yeah, the girl.
No talking, no cell phones. You will be physically kicked onto the street.
Yeah, ideally, yes.
Fear of God. I like that. That is super fantastically cool. Yeah, so we definitely want to refer people, you know, even if you watch it on Chiller, maybe especially if you watch it on Chiller, it's nothing like seeing it on the big screen, of mm-hmm. course, and of course that sounds to me like that's a lot of the Alamo Draft House philosophy, is there's nothing like the big screen and a dedicated experience, film experience, involving food and drink, and so definitely you should definitely check out the site, theamericanscreammovie.com, and it will tell you where upcoming screenings are. It's pretty much, you know, it's most every day, not quite, but most every day through October, and then into November, lots and lots of showings, lots of Alamo Draft House viewings I am seeing in various locations. So anyway, go check that out. And from what I have seen in the first half, it really is engrossing. And I kept punching my frickin' computer. You do not stop halfway through this movie. Although I was running out of time too, I had to talk to you soon. So let's talk about you. What is your background, and how did you end up in this situation and talking with me on the phone about The American Scream?
Well, I guess the best link for telling that story is how I ended up being close friends with Michael and Lindsay, who, you know, are making these movies. They're a couple where she's kind of the producer and the power force that pushes things forward, and then Michael is this great creative mind, and you know, he's a director and he's written stuff. And so anyway, he also, prior to being that, he was a child actor and he starred in the movie Troll 2, which is widely regarded as
the worst. My God.
Yeah, right.
And that's what his other movie's about, right?
Yeah, he's regarded as the star of the worst, you know, horror movie ever made, if not the worst movie ever made. And so he parlayed that experience into that documentary that he directed called Best Worst Movie, about why are people obsessed with this awful, rotten movie. And it turns out that the movie's not so awful and rotten, and a lot of people really like it. And that was kind of what that story was about. I don't think anyone was expecting it to get as much attention as it did. And, you know, like Roger Ebert loved it, and all these people wrote about it saying it was a really kind of top drawer documentary. And one of the nerds that they talked to about the movie, about Troll 2 appreciation, and that was me. And when I met them, I really hit it off with Michael, and we became immediate friends. And when Michael and Lindsay's first daughter was born, he called me from the hospital to talk to me about it. And it was just kind of like we'd known each other for years, but right away. And we're just, you know, like best pals right away. And I just wanted to continue working with them.
What do you like about Troll 2?
Well, that my whole appreciation of Troll 2 is rooted in a lifelong appreciation of things like
Troll
that.
Troll 1? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Of what?
I said Troll 1?
No, not at all.
No, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, that's all right, I've always loved movies that are made by people who don't have a lot of money and who don't have a lot of means or even experience or talent necessarily. I've always appreciated that they went ahead and did it anyway. So when other people are watching movies like Troll 2 or, you know, there's just all kinds of stuff like that, Deadly Prey, Miami Connection, like these are movies that people like to laugh at, but to me, I like to appreciate the film and applaud it. And it's like, I don't consider them so bad they're good, I just think that they're good. Because if I'm entertained watching a movie, then the movie's good, and I don't really question it. So, like, you know, I consider Troll 2 to be a better movie than Iron Man, because Iron Man was boring and Troll 2 was entertaining. So, you know.
That is funny.
So anyway, I really believe this, and it's kind of a crusade with me to, like, defend these movies that people pick on unnecessarily.
Got it.
And that's, you know, I have 3,000 VHS tapes of movies that have never come out on DVD because, to me, these movies are totally valid. Yeah.
That's astonishing.
But, you know, I mean,
they've never been on DVD. I thought every movie of all time had been on DVD. I thought they were all on Blu-ray.
You're kidding me, right?
Kind of.
Okay, good.
No, I really did think most movies had made it to DVD by now.
It's about 40%, a little over 40%
really?
Of movies released on VHS have still not made it to DVD, and are probably, you know, not going to, because now no one's paying attention to that, and they're all looking at Blu-ray and all
that.
Right,
that's a dead format now. The life of the formats gets shorter and shorter.
Yeah, it's pretty strange, because people just let these things go, and, you know, they just figure, well, I don't care if 40% of movies can never be seen again as long as I have my Blu-ray. Like, to me, that means that you hate movies. So, my personal.
So you're saying 60% have made it to DVD?
Yeah, but that's not very much. I mean, what if 60% of your body, you know, made it through a doorway? Like, you wouldn't be too happy about that. So, I figure, you know.
Well, I imagine there's thousands, or at least hundreds, probably thousands, of movies that never even made it to video in the first place.
They estimate that there's about 35,000 movies that never made it at all to any home video format. And then.
Wow.
This is something I think about too much. And then about 45,000 movies that are on VHS but never made it to anything after that, and then so on and so on.
And that's out of how many total movies?
About between 230,000 and 250,000, according to Scarecrow Video, who's the biggest video store in the world, and they research stuff like this. I used to work there.
Interesting.
So my movie obsession is really runs deep, and I have to check myself before I just explode into all of these figures.
Oh, no, we love passion. Passion's good. Passion fills time very well. No, I find that just fascinating. So you're saying 250,000 movies ever made?
Yeah.
Is that American? Is that – what are the parameters of that number?
I think it's that 250,000 feature films internationally, excluding adult movies, have made it to some – or have been produced, like, in the last 100 years. And then
that's not
all but like 35,000 of those have been released somewhere on some kind of watchable video format, you know, and then like 60.
That's actually fairly impressive if you think about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's great because there's so many companies that needed content to make money and,
right,
you know, different markets. Like, there's a bunch of American movies that have only ever come out on VHS in Japan. Because they couldn't get anyone to release them in the U.S. So there's like real low-rent, you know, shot-on-video horror stuff from the 80s that was made in Hollywood, but it only ever came out in Tokyo.
Interesting. So now how do you find these? I mean, how do you find the ones that you decide that – I mean, with that kind of volume, and of course most of them are cheap, you know, most of them are – relatively poorly made, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do you decide the ones that just stand out? I mean, in other words, why is Troll 2 better than thousands, tens of thousands of other movies that have similar attributes, at least, you know, at least if you were to, you know, boil it down to the basics.
Well, a movie like Troll 2 is a really remarkable example because that movie is kind of universally entertaining. Like, people who don't expect to be entertained by kind of low-brow, low-budget horror movies get pulled into that because it's so bizarre and unique. And I think that's a lot of what makes a movie like that work is that it's like nothing else that anyone has ever seen before. It exists in a world without any sort of, you know, rational logic, and people speak in dialogue that no human being would ever say. And so that was really special. But to me, I mean, just hunting for videos in general is I just want to find something that I didn't know existed and be entertained by it in a way that I've not been entertained by another movie. And so that's why I have thousands of these movies. I have like an entire bedroom of my house that's like hyper-organized, super clean, like VHS alphabetized wall, you know. And to me, that's my main obsession. And when I travel, all I do is look for old VHS tapes. And, like, my wife has to she's just used to it. My friends are used to it. Yeah, I mean, she's into it. She appreciates it, you know. It's just very much like the Obsessive Haunters in the American Scream documentary. It's just like, this is what I do, except what those guys do is a lot more social and a lot more visually impressive.
So how much time do you give a typical movie? I mean, there's only so many hours in the day. Look, I can relate. I have 30,000 CDs and records. I cannot listen to them all on a regular basis.
Right. Like, if you listen to them back-to-back, you'd die of old age before you got to, like, the letter, you know, C, probably. I mean, we both would, you know?
It's a problem. And people say, why do you need three rooms stacked with shelves of CDs and records? And I say, well, I don't know. Need? What is need? What is the meaning of is? You know, what is the definition of is? I mean, do I need them? No. But I, as an archivist, as a music historian, as an author, I mean, you know, most of my professional background involves thinking about, writing about, you know, DJing, et cetera, music. So, I mean, at least I have that part of it. And I mean, we, for example, we used that, my collection, as the foundation when we were creating a discography database when we were planning the Encyclopedia of Record Producers, which was my kind of last big book. Now I'm working on America's Most Haunted, very excited about that, first book in over 10 years. But previous to that, prior to that, my most, I guess, best-known book was Encyclopedia of Record Producers. So, I mean, but that's a long time ago. So what's my reason for hanging on to them and, just like you, keeping them really, really, really anally organized? You know, and I have lots of people come in, they look at them, they go, I don't even know where to start. And I say, what do you mean you don't know where to start? They're in perfect order.
Well, you know, those people probably don't acknowledge, I mean, you can answer this question better than anybody. How many LPs never made it to CD and then aren't on iTunes or aren't on these places? You know, like a tremendous percentage, right?
A lot, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's by now, you know, all these years, now that the CD era is about, well, I guess it's, what, 25 years already. I didn't switch over. I didn't even buy a CD player until 90. So, you know, it had been going on for about 5 years. I mean, the really early adopters were mid-80s. Pretty much everyone had them by the late 80s. I was really slow just because I said, just like with you with VHS, my God, I got all these records. Why don't I start over again? But, you know, but I did, inevitably. And enjoy CDs very much, and came to appreciate them. I don't like, you know, as everyone knows, there are things about LPs, physical things that you don't get with the CDs. You don't get that nice big flat artwork on each side. Even
right.
If you get the exact same cover, it's in greatly reduced form and folded up, you know, and stuffed in the jewel case. And,
yeah.
You know, so you don't really have that experience. I mean, it's, I suppose, simulated, but it's not the same thing to sit there and pore over your record cover while you're listening to your record and then having one side end and flipping it over and listening to the other side.
That's all I do. I don't have a CD player. I only have LPs, and I'm not old. You know,
I bet you have a lot of those.
I have about 4,000.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That is a lot. Yep. I love my records. I was a DJ with records for many, that's how far back I go, for many, many, many years. And, you know, we can sing the praises of records. But there's very positive things about CDs. I love the fact that they stay much cleaner sounding, much longer. If you take care of them, they, in theory, do not wear out. No matter how well you take care of a record, there is that mechanical drag, you know, literally of the needle on the grooves. And eventually that will wear it out, no matter how well you take care of it. But... yeah, interesting. Very interesting parallels. How many VHS did you say you have?
About 3,000, and then probably like 600 DVDs.
So you are a movie guy, and very interesting to hear your philosophy of you're definitely attaching kind of an ethic to it, whereas you're looking at seems to me, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but there's almost like a calculus inside your head as far as the ratio of budget to entertainment value. I mean, that's important to you.
Well, in what way? That VHS is more financially attainable, or?
Well, I'm talking, that side of it too. I was thinking actually of the film creation.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Well, where you're giving movies more credit for being entertaining within X amount of budget versus, you know, essentially an unlimited budget like an Iron Man.
Yeah, my theory is like any idiot should be able to make an entertaining movie if they're handed even $10 million, much less $100 million. And what's funny to me is that like there's no way I could stay awake watching Avatar, and they spent like $1 billion on that movie. And yet I've watched movies that are made by people in their backyards with like $300 that I've been completely entertained by and riveted by. And that means that those are good filmmakers, and, you know, the big budget movies in Hollywood are failures. You know, it's just a matter of really basic, black and white, like, are you entertained or not? And it's how many times have you gone to see a big movie at a Cineplex that was produced by a studio and just not liked it very much? You know,
that's a very good point. Hey, before we run out of time, as always, it seems, the hour has gone very, very quickly. We've touched on a lot of different really interesting things. We could certainly get more into the whole technology and budget and entertainment philosophy. I find that fascinating. But our good friend Babette Bombshell has some more really good questions. So let me just kind of toss them all out there, and you can pick and choose, because we only have about 3 minutes left. Okay, so very good question. How have the families responded to seeing the documentary?
That is a great question. Victor has a moment that you will see when you eventually see the whole movie, where he has a complete blowout, where his frustrations and the stress just gets to him, and he just starts rampaging around his house and swearing, and it's totally entertaining. And he was a great sport about it. He totally accepted that that's part of their Halloween creation every year, and he was not ashamed of his behavior. And everyone seems to be happy with how they're represented and depicted in the movie. We didn't do any tricky editing to create more drama than necessary or anything like that.
None of these people are particularly glamorous.
No, most people in the real world aren't.
That is so true.
I prefer people that aren't in general. But yeah, everyone's happy with it. I think Manny, you know, being the blue collar hunter, he was more surprised than anybody that it wasn't just about the haunt props and making the haunted houses, but it was really just about the people that do it. And I think that kind of caught him by surprise. But he's also been supportive of the movie. He just was expecting it to be more like, you know, top 100 Halloween countdown type shows, and it's just not that type of story.
Her question continues, do the families have any plans to go to the Haunters Convention, since now they're kind of going to be celebrities within that world?
I mean, if they do have those plans, they haven't spoken about it. I think they're just so amazed that this whole thing actually came together and there's really going to be a coast-to-coast broadcast of their stories, you know, in less than a week.
Yeah.
So they haven't started
That's
making
very
any plans
exciting.
For...
It really is.
Yeah.
I bet they'll be glued to their TVs, and they won't care if it's in HD.
That's probably true.
So that's so hilarious when I asked you earlier near the beginning of the call about the chiller in HD. You're like the last guy on earth I should talk to about that.
That's true. I'll tell you a secret.
That is funny. That just shows what a bonehead I am. All right. So, Babette, one more question.
Okay.
Now, you're not the director, so we need to clarify that. You're
right.
A producer. It was Michael who's the director. But do you guys kind of collectively have any intention or desire to move into non-documentary films?
Very much so. And this was announced in a few places online, in a small way. But our next project, all of us together, is going to be a narrative film. It's like a dark comedy, kind of sort of a horror movie, but not really. And that is what everybody is jumping into. And we're going to be working with Jennifer Roth, who's one of the producers on Black Swan.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Fascinating. Wow. Well, that really is interesting. And this is quite a success story. So I really want to congratulate you on it. I have zero doubt that the second half of the film is just as good. And the teasers you've tossed out really kind of confirm it for me. I'm sure that it comes to a very gratifying conclusion. I think you guys really did a great job in allowing the families to be themselves and to tell their own stories. And it really is a great and very touching story because these are just regular people. These are not movie stars. These are not even particularly glamorous non-movie stars. They're just people out there doing their thing. And it shows how really committed they are. And by the way, Babette has told us, great show. So we we are pleased for that. So once again, we're off of the live, but it does keep recording until we shut up. So let's let people know one more time that the website is theamericanscreammovie.com. All information is available there, including where the movie is screening. Once again, it is showing on the Chiller Network. It's Sunday, right? This Sunday?
Yeah, this Sunday.
At 8 o'clock. That will be extremely exciting, I am certain, for everyone involved. And really, really enjoyed speaking with you, Zach Carlson. You are one of the producers of the film and a very articulate defender and explainer of what you guys did. How you guys did it, and I really appreciate your time and wish you only the best of luck with this and subsequent projects.
Thank you very much, you too.
Thanks, Zach. Hope to talk to you again.
You
farewell.
Too, thank you. All right, bye-bye.